Hi, and welcome back to another episode of the Outsource Accelerator podcast. This is episode number 318. Today, I am joined by Cyril Rock. He is the CEO of Data One Asia. We go deep today on data centers, data security, technical infrastructure, and all that fun stuff. It's a little bit technical, but it is so interesting that all of this is so important and yet not a lot of us even put any time into thinking about the technical infrastructure of our increasingly globalized and online businesses. So we go deep on this topic with Cyril today. I certainly learned a huge amount. We talk about everything from data security to Google's recent downtime issue to server infrastructure. And we also mentioned Amazon and Google and what you need to know about these things. This is maybe more focused on the enterprise level of the market, but it is super interesting if you know you are wondering how the world is going globalized and the requirements and the safety knowledge we all need to know to ensure that all of this keeps on the rails. So I certainly had a fantastic talk to Cyril and learned a lot. If you want any of the show notes, go to outsourceaccelerator.com/podcast. Enjoy. This podcast is brought to you by Outsource Accelerator. We are the world's leading outsourcing marketplace and advisory. We help big and small businesses with their outsourcing needs, and we can help you too. We cover everything from business and staffing strategy, optimal outsourcing structures, implementations, and fully managed services. If you're already outsourcing, about to start, or somewhere in between, then we can ensure that you get the best from outsourcing. That's the best prices, best terms, and of course, the best results from your outsourcing practices. We list over 700 outsourcing suppliers on our website, host this leading outsourcing podcast, and have over 5,000 pages of content. Because we span the entire market, we can ensure that you get the best deal possible. We offer everything from light brokerage, co-managed services, through to fully managed solutions. Get in touch today. Visit us at outsourceaccelerator.com/quote. Mention that you're a podcast listener, and we will give you special attention plus a 10% discount. This is for a limited time only. Go to outsourceaccelerator.com/quote. I started off our conversation with Cyril by asking him to give us a brief history of the outsourcing industry's data services, server, and IT infrastructure requirements.
Derek, I think the BPO industry does not really go back 25 years ago. I would say maybe 20 years ago. And I remember because I was here, and the main drivers for the BPO industry to develop, to expand here, actually at the beginning, it was not a given. There were lots of challenges and there were lots of doubts about whether the Philippines could actually be successful as a BPO platform. And there were a number of key ingredients that made the Philippines successful. Number one, there was a vast labor force, English speaking, with a good level of education, that was largely unemployed. So that was the first input to make sure that the BPO could take off. The other things are rather a bit on the negative side. There was also an oversupply of office space directly after the Asian crisis, 98-2000. So there was a lot of high-grade office space available at a fairly low rate. And there was another element that kicked in. There was also a quite a large oversupply of fiber optic submarine cables all over Asia that drove the prices down. So all of that kickstarted the BPO industry in the Philippines. So largely the BPOs rented offices, set them up with desks, PCs, network, and then connected that to the internet. So depending on the kind of business you're in, either you rent a big floor and you build your computer room, you put your servers and you put your firewalls and you try to get a couple of carriers to connect to the World Wide Web. Or for other applications, say financial services or healthcare, which are require a high level of security and are subject to certain regulations, let's say in the US, the data cannot leave the home country. So actually the data stays on systems in the home country, say in the US in that case. So the infrastructure in the Philippines would be much lighter with network infrastructure, but no data actually residing here, just access to the data. So there were different kinds of environment, but generally the BPOs had, especially the captives one controlled by a parent company, had clear ideas of what they wanted to achieve. And because there was not much available in the Philippines, then they either built it themselves or they kept it outside. So that was the setup. Now it's becoming a little bit more, there's more diversity in terms of telco coming to the Philippines. There's more capacity. There are more operators locally. So it's not just limited to the two larger carriers, Pierliti and Globe. There's a few more offering fiber optic to buildings and also to the home. So there are more options.
Where do you see the considerations are for businesses when offshoring then? When do you think it's important for them to say, hey, we really need to put a lot of thought into the server configuration and infrastructure? Or is it, you know, just in the cloud and everyone can take it for granted? Does a business of two VAs need to consider this? Or is it really just a sort of a company of 100 plus staff? Where do you see the sort of tipping point?
No, I think it depends on the application. But also it may depend on the company philosophy. You have companies, global companies that run operations in the Philippines for outsourcing to support the global market. But if you're looking at banking systems, for instance, this does not run on the Amazon or equivalent platforms. It still requires the heavy-duty mainframes or specialized hardware. So we are back into specialized infrastructure hosted in a data center. Now, some large operation, whether healthcare or credit card, still may want to control their infrastructure and manage it themselves in different data centers the world over. So it doesn't mean that the cloud is there, the Amazon and Google and Microsoft are there, that everything will be migrated there. Internet-facing applications might be hosted on the hyperscale cloud providers, but more mission-critical and critical data might still be run on company-owned infrastructure. So it's what we described as the hybrid infrastructure. So it's not necessarily all on the cloud or all on company-owned, but it often is a combination.
Right. And you were saying, you know, prior to the call as well, that there is the Amazon, there's the big infrastructure, but to put everything on there still doesn't guarantee you results. You still need to manage those.
Yes.
The data centers there. Can you talk to that?
Yes. So if you look at the emergence of cloud and the development of Amazon, the at the start was more a cost saving drive by innovators like VMware. So the first idea was to virtualize servers and reduce the footprint, reduce the amount of capital investment you have in servers, storage, and network. So that was the first emergence of the cloud concept. And this was embraced by Amazon, who offered it on a very large scale and made it extremely sophisticated in terms of offering. Now, the key concept of Amazon is self-service, meaning that you empower the user to create a machine of any size and use it for any duration, be it a few days or a few weeks or a few months. So you transfer a lot of power to developers and to users versus the old model, which is you have to acquire, you have to buy an asset. So this was very, very liberating. Now, when you have large businesses moving to the cloud, what happens is you still need teams of qualified engineers who manage the infrastructure. You have to make sure that they are competent. And because they are competent and certified, they tend to be expensive. And so that's one aspect. So you don't decrease the dependency on your IT team. In fact, you become even more dependent on some key people. The other aspect is economic. Cloud pricing is very effective for burst, meaning you have utilization that vary in amount of compute power over a short period of time. And but if you have a base load, utilization, meaning that you have a stable utilization of resources, say for a bank or for similar or utility, then the cloud tends to be less attractive in terms of cost over a long period of time, say 4, 5, 7 years. So if you run what we call a total cost of ownership, it may make more sense to build and operate your own infrastructure or to subscribe to a different kind of service provider.
In the news at the moment is a lot about data security and privacy and data sovereignty.
Yes.
And as everything is becoming more globalized and everything's in the cloud, do people really know who owns what and what laws apply? And that's a pretty complicated thing to unpick, yeah?
Yes. So these are different concepts. When you mention data privacy, or the Data Privacy Act in the Philippines, this pertains to a law that was actually patterned after the GDPR in Europe for the protection of personal data. So the Philippines has implemented that laws here, which require businesses to ensure that whenever they hold private data about individuals, they are kept safely, they are not distributed, they are not sold, or they are not exploited in an improper way. So you must make sure that they are protected, people who have access to them are authorized, or they can be encrypted. So this is one aspect. And obviously you have to implement security measures to make sure that no one can improperly access this data. Data sovereignty is another idea. Data sovereignty is the concept that a country should make sure that the data of its most important administrations, government entities, and large enterprises, critical enterprises like, say, utilities, banks, healthcare, large real estate, large retailers, stay in country. So you have such regulations in Europe, in the US, in Japan, Taiwan, Singapore, Indonesia, Vietnam, because they realize that that if the essential data of the largest banks, for instance, resides somewhere else, in case of conflict or in case of dispute or tax dispute, that could be a major issue. Unfortunately, such a concept or law has not been enforced in the Philippines, which means that any company literally could host its data on a hyperscale cloud provider outside, and that would be legal. And that, in a way, is exposing this country to certain risks. And on the other hand, it also has prevented the emergence of large cloud industries. So, say, Amazon is operating in Hong Kong. Amazon is operating in Singapore. I believe that Amazon also has instances in Indonesia, but they are not here. So DataOne offer cloud services in the country, not using Amazon technology. But one of our arguments is that for certain industries, even though it's not regulated, it is in their strategic interest to keep the data here for security.
This whole global matrix that we're building, and for many people it's just happening in the background, it's under the bonnet and people aren't really aware of it, but data is being stored somewhere, it's being moved across different platforms, and there are now increasing data protection laws and requirements. Do you think this is a hornet's nest that everyone is just innocently ignorant of that could blow up one day? Have you ever heard of any cases that have been challenged or any precedents yet?
Oh, yeah. I have had customers that were in the online e-commerce, and I don't want to go into details, but there have been lawsuits and legal challenges against them. And because they were hosted with a global cloud provider in a US jurisdiction, they would have been exposed to closing the site. So you can be exposed in case of dispute to losing your data or to losing your business. So the question of where the data reside is very important, because it could be also subject to a different legal jurisdiction. And this can apply to numerous businesses, even government agencies. So if government agencies store data and suddenly there's a dispute with another government, you can be exposed to serious threats. So this is not something that's negligible. And I think most countries that have looked at it understand the risks, and that's why they have required their critical pieces of the economy and government to be hosted in country, so that only the laws of the country apply to those operations.
And where does the Philippines sit along that spectrum? How developed are the laws and regulations of the country? How transparent are they? What recourse is there? And do you see it as a safe place to have data centers, basically?
Yes, I mean, so different things. So as I said earlier, there's no data sovereignty law in the Philippines. There are bits and pieces of regulations. Say the BIR may want to have access to the data of a financial system to make sure that taxes are paid. Which implies that the data may have to stay in the country, or there's a backup in the country, but it's not an all-encompassing concept. So, again, there's no regulation requiring Philippine businesses to keep their data in country. And the same actually goes for the government. The government host some of its data outside, and I'm not sure they have fully taken into account the security risks of this practice. Now, is it safe to keep the data in the country? Yes, because then you just have to apply and implement all the best practices that you would design and devise in other parts of the world. So you have here large global banks, healthcare, credit bureau, etc., that operate here with global standards, and they can apply the same security standards as they would in other places. So this is not an issue.
And would you see the Philippines potentially then if, you know, obviously labor costs are cheaper, people are getting a lot of their professional services done. Could this be potentially a global center where people are used to manage globalized data requirements, data centers and things like that? Do you see that happening in the Philippines?
Why not? But you need a legal framework where you feel very safe, that you can retrieve the data, that no legal entity or government could request access to it. So you need the proper legal framework, and it could be developed. So there's no issue with that. Next is, I think you're absolutely right, that there's a large qualified workforce in the Philippines, and the labor cost is a major consideration for managing data and managing infrastructure. So it's a very significant component. All the rest, the cost of infrastructure, the cost of storage, network, software, hardware is the same globally. So it's not a differentiator. And also you have a very large number now, increasing density of submarine cables landing in the Philippines. So it means that from here we can reach the east coast of the US, Japan, Taiwan, South Asia, North Asia. So it's quite well strategically located as a hub. And there's another component for the future of data centers for all the global players who are looking at the Philippines is the cost of energy. And the cost of energy is still high here. It's one of the highest in Asia. And another trend, and a significant trend for data centers, is the consideration that renewable energies should be a significant input in powering data centers. So I think the next generation, if there's one and there will be one, will be powered by renewable and will benefit from those inputs of qualified competitive labor and massive submarine cable infrastructure.
We're talking on the 15th of December, we're recording this, and just yesterday it was Google went down.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if you saw this, but Gmail went down, YouTube went down.
Yes.
I would imagine that, you know, and it was for quite a long time.
Yeah.
What goes into this 100% uptime, and how difficult is it, and how many safeguards are there in place to ensure that there's redundancies on redundancies?
Well, I've not read the details about the cause of this incident, but definitely Google has some of the most qualified engineers in the whole world, and I'm sure they have devised all the redundancies. But sometimes you have systemic flaws, or it's like Moore's law, something happening, it triggers a chain reaction into making the whole thing collapse. So that's a bit the issue with very large systems, whoever they are, you know, some of them, what we call hyperscale cloud providers, is one incident triggers a failover onto another data center who may be overloaded, who triggers a failover in another data center. There's a chain reaction and everything is collapsing. That's why some businesses prefer to still be in charge of part of their core infrastructure and just move to the cloud certain things that are less critical.
And does redundancy in essence just mean spare capacity? And at what level would people run a spare capacity? Because I would imagine if you run it, let's say 70% capacity at all times, you would not have a spare 70% capacity just sitting there just in case you need it, because that would simply, I mean, in essence, it would double the cost for a 1 in 1,000 use chance. How do people sort of justify the or at what point do they justify redundancy and extra capacity to which point it then becomes too expensive to warrant?
Some businesses run with 100% spare capacity, meaning if the primary fails, they switch to the secondary, which is we can back up 100% of the original production site. So it doubles the cost, but that's your only guarantee. Now, if you have a 20% spare capacity or less, that's what in data centers we call N plus one or N plus whatever, meaning that if you have, for instance, 10 servers, you have one for backup, because, or you have five aircon, you have one for backup, because you assume that they will not fail at the same time. And it's an issue of cost, it's an issue of probability, but sometimes something bad happens. And if you have two that fail at that moment, then you don't have any redundancy anymore. So it's really a matter of optimizing cost and probabilities. Whenever you discuss those issues with customers, they will think, some may say it's just too expensive, so I go for that option. But then there's a probability of risk. That's why we talk about 99.9 or 99.999 or 95% of times. The 0.1 or the 0.05% is the risk. And this is what happened with Google. It doesn't happen often, but when it does, it's a major downtime.
And people overlook the 99.99%, but 0.1% is actually quite a lot of time.
Yes.
If you're expected to be up every minute of every day of every year,
yes,
then that 0.1% is actually a significant amount of downtime, isn't it?
Yes. But let's say it's the same for data centers. You have different tiers of data center that measure their uptime. So, say tier 3 is 99.9 or 99.95% of guaranteed uptime, and tier 4, which is government or military grade, is more than that. But the cost increase is really exponential, and very few companies are willing to pay for that. So they adopt different strategies to mitigate the risk.
And where do you see, you know, there's obviously we've had coronavirus, there's always international friction, and we're at relative times of peace at the moment. But where do you see the risk of data security in terms of like international relations? And, you know, if Google went down for a period of days or a month, then it would wipe billions off of economic activity. Do you see this as an emerging concern of international data security and protection, and that could potentially be the new frontier of friction and wars and skirmish?
Yeah, so actually I see different aspects of your question. So for instance, we have this conversation over an application that's working perfectly. We have Zoom, I'm using Zoom, but it could be other applications daily, many times a day. And we have a meeting at a specific time. Everybody is there at the exact minute, and we expect it to work perfectly. A lot of businesses now depend on certain application, e-commerce. I know some schools depend or operate exclusively on Zoom, for instance. So if this goes down, the economic impact is dramatic. So I'm not sure everybody has measured that yet. And that's why we need backup. So I'll just give you a simple example for me. Today I'm still at home, but I had to subscribe to a second internet link, which doubles my cost. But that's redundancy. So the first level of protection is to make sure I always have the internet. So for employees working from home, that might be a requirement in the future. You cannot not report for work or to a meeting because you don't have a proper internet at home. So yes. The other thing is, because employees, because of the pandemic, many companies have continued operating with their employees working from home. This has opened massive opportunities for cyber risks and cyber attacks. The networks at home were not designed in the same manner that the networks in an office. In an office, it's a closed environment. You have a network that is wired. You have IT people who control the firewalls. You have access control. You know what people are doing. You know what doing with their cameras. At home, it's a totally different story. And this is opening, huge risks for businesses. They are gradually being addressed, but this is one of the things that we'll have to look at because based on our analysis, and we have actually written a white paper on this, we believe that work from home will continue to prevail in the future for a variety of reasons. And therefore, the concepts of cybersecurity has to be adapted to a work from home environment.
That is a fascinating take, really, isn't it? And you know, going back to the beginning of my conversation, it was BPOs that basically created these secure, reliable bubbles within the developing nation that, you know, outside of the walls of the BPO, it was pretty unreliable, it was pretty insecure, but the BPOs could ensure that a facility had redundancy and backup and downtime prevention. But now that everyone's going into the community, you're really sort of face to face with a developing economy and the flaws that has with it. And also the security concerns that has with it. But what really can be done there, Cyril, is it sort of you're really limited to what can be done and how you can manage people's own home environment.
Yes, yes. Actually, this is a real concern. But I'll give you an example. We have a client. I will not give too many details because it's a customer of ours. But their business is to teach English to French professionals who are in France. Over the internet, so using different platforms, video conferencing, etc. And so you use the best Filipino talent, English speakers who are expert in engineering, in legal matters, etc., who will teach that kind of English to executives in Europe. So they started with having their teachers in physical facilities. In an office which we equipped, but over the years it appears that the time difference and transportation cost and time made it very difficult to find the right talent. So they already started to facilitate working from home when putting infrastructure at home many years ago before the pandemic. So this trend started before, because public transport in Manila, it's very challenging. So working from home is something that has been tested before. Now, the pandemic is accelerating this. And I think it's very interesting to see that one of the most recent successful IPOs is Telco, Converge ICT. I don't want to advertise for them, but that's a fact. And their offering is essentially fiber to the home. So the pandemic has accelerated the trend to deliver fiber to the home to facilitate, to help the life of students, families, and everybody working from home, because that's the demand has been tremendous. So that's the first thing, is to make sure there's fiber to the home or fiber to the condominiums. And the next, there's another set of technologies that we have been promoting that fall into the categories of virtual desktop. You know, we discussed that during one of our events, virtual desktop, whereby the data does not reside on your computer where you are at home, but remains in a remote server, on a cloud server. so that it helps still comply with the data protection requirement of your customer. So if your employee is at home in a remote part of Manila, at any time, he doesn't have access to the data, to the critical data of the transaction or its customers. So there are solutions that exist that are cost effective and that will still allow people to work from different places in the future. And I think that will stay with us.
It seems that technology is fundamentally, it enables freedom and mobility, but I suppose the lagging infrastructure is the security and the reliability of those services. And I assume that it will catch up, but it seems a funny thing that people expect security, but they don't necessarily want to pay for it or give it much attention. They just expect it there in the background, don't they?
Yes, but I think also prices will drop over time as more and more people use it. The price per user will drop. And eventually, businesses will realize that once they start reducing their real estate footprint, what they save there, they can reallocate into equipment and security for the employees. So my view is, let's say next year or the next 2 years, real estate footprint could reduce by 20-30% for businesses because they will request the employees to work 1 or 2 days less per week at the office, but they will spend more on devices and security to still be compliant with industry standards.
Absolutely. And do you know, there's a lot of regulatory guidance in terms of data privacy, HIPAA compliance, PCI compliance. Do you think that eventually, now it's not really feasible, but eventually that home environments could become compliant with those security regulations?
We have been discussing to some companies that provide tools and systems for security. And I think we know that working from home is not the same as working from an office. In an office, you may have CCTVs. You may request employees to relinquish their phone, not to take pictures, etc., etc. So you know what they are doing. In a home environment, it's different. However, there are tools now using artificial intelligence that can detect behavior, suspect behavior, and anticipate activities that are suspect. So I think that there, you know, it's more of a legal issue of intrusion in your freedom as an employee rather than the technology. I think the technologies exist already. It's just a matter of finding a way to deploy them.
And any process is really, it's part technology, but it's part protocol,
yes.
Isn't it?
As yes.
In don't yes. have mobile phones within the room, so then you can't take photos of the screen. And,
yes.
and that really isn't a technology issue. That's more yes. of a process and procedure.
Yeah, so all those processes can be implemented in an office environment, but obviously in a home, you cannot do that. So you must use different tools. So it's possible that certain industries will not be able to switch entirely to work from home, let's say credit card processing or healthcare claims processing, but possibly with certain applications, tools, and devices, things may change. So it may not necessarily be work from home, but work from a different kind of office. Instead of a centralized office where you have thousands of people, it may be a new kind of satellite office that is compliant with certain procedures and standards. We have to be ready for any kind of solution that may come up in the future.
Well, it's a fascinating topic, and it is amazing how complex and how important all of this is, yet it often, more often than not, just happens in the background without any direct attention from the vast majority of people. It's really an incredible, but it highlights how important it is, especially like with the Google incident,
yeah.
to have proper systems and proper infrastructure in place, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah. There's never enough backup. You always must have a plan A, a plan B, a plan C, so that if Google doesn't work, then you have something else to rely on.
Is there a magic number, Cyril? If your servers cost you $100,000 a year, is there a magic number of 20% on top for redundancy, or is that just oversimplistic?
If you want to have 100% backup, so you have an infrastructure, a certain amount of servers, etc. And if you want to replicate the whole thing, it's going to cost twice as much. But it doesn't necessarily guarantee 100% uptime, because you may have systemic issues. For instance, say if the two operations are in Metro Manila and there's a problem in the Philippines, and if the Philippines is affected, then the whole thing goes down. So it's all a matter of probability and assessing what risk you're trying to cover. But the closer you get to 100%, the cost tend to go exponentially. So nobody really wants to reach 100% because it doesn't make sense.
Well, I've certainly learned a lot, Cyril, on a topic that I should know a lot more about. So I certainly appreciate your time. And of course, if anyone wants to reach out to you or know more about what you do, how can they do that?
Yes. So thank you, Derek. So I'm the CEO of Data One Asia, and I'm also the CEO of Finacore Technology Finance. And we are offering infrastructure and security services to businesses that have a presence in the Philippines. So if you want to reach us, please check our website, dataoneasia.com or finacore.com.
And I'll put all of that in the show notes. That was Cyril Rock of Data One Asia. And if you want to get in touch with Cyril or get any of the links mentioned here, go to our show notes, which is at outsourceaccelerator.com/podcast. And as always, if you want to send us an email, just email us at ask@outsourceaccelerator.com. See you next time.